from St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Missouri holds a unique distinction among GOP-leaning states, having a robust and politically significant organized labor community. Individual unions often play a major role in campaigns for statewide and state legislative offices. But Missouri isn't exactly a utopia for either labor leaders or union members. The GOP-led legislature often introduces bills that, if enacted, could curb the power of labor. And Missouri's labor community is hardly a monolith, as was seen in the hotly contested race between Congresswoman Cori Bush and St. Louis County Prosecutor Wesley Bell. Joining us now to discuss the status of organized labor in Missouri is Jake Hummel, the president of the Missouri AFL-CIO. Hummel is a former Missouri lawmaker who served as House Minority Leader and as a member of the Missouri Senate. Jake, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Jason, thanks for having me.
And for full...
Great to be back.
Oh, great to see you. And for full disclosure, before this conversation unfolds, I am a member of two labor unions, SEIU whenever I teach at Washington University, and CWA by virtue of working at St. Louis Public Radio. My favorite parlor trick to say I'm part of two unions.
That is great. That is great.
All right, let's start off with a basic question.
Sure.
What does the Missouri AFL-CIO do from a functional standpoint?
So Missouri AFL-CIO is, for all intents and purposes, the umbrella organization for the vast majority of unions throughout the state. We do everything from the lobbying in the state legislature to multiple avenues of campaign work, both locally and statewide. We are engaged in organizing drives. We support our members through many different avenues. We have a huge workforce development arm that has worked to get people into the construction trades, safety for healthcare workers, and now we're getting ready to move into advanced manufacturing.
And when we talk about the AFL-CIO representing a lot of different type of workers, usually they're lumped into two very generalized groups,
mm-hmm.
trade unions and service unions. Can you talk about the difference between these two admittedly very general descriptors?
They are, and I think that, you know, when you think of a trade union, I think people think of construction trades, and I don't think that's actually completely accurate. I think we have machinists and steel workers, all of these different avenues of manufacturing, and they're journey level people that are working in these industries. And then on the service sector, we have so many, I don't even know where to begin. So we have the home healthcare workers, we have nurses, we have the food and commercial, the grocery workers at Schnucks, Dierberg, Straub's, and some of the other ones. We have the meat cutters. We have the film industry. We have the television industry. We have the folks that produce and put on the shows at the Muni, at the Fox. We have government employees, federal government employees. So almost every government building across the state is filled with American Federation of Government Employees union members. And we run the gamut all the way across almost every industry.
Do you think that there has been some tension between trade unions and service unions throughout the year? Or is that an overblown conflict that silly political reporters like myself build up more than it should?
I think that, you know, occasionally when you get down to maybe one specific race that I'm sure we'll probably mention here later on, I'm sure there's some tension on what is important to each group. But what I would say is that depending upon the issue, there are things that are more important to one group than the other, and there's always going to be that in every industry because we are so diverse. And we take that into account, and we listen to both sides and try to make an educated decision.
To this day, unions are a major element of the Democratic Party, both in terms of how they contribute to campaigns and the party's electoral coalition. That being said, there has been plenty of coverage about how rank-and-file union members, especially in trade unions, maybe more politically conservative than the leadership. First of all, is that accurate? And if so, why is that the case?
The vast majority are not super conservative. I'd say the vast majority are more center-leaning in the trades. I think that, some of the things I think that are out there. Do we have hard right members? Absolutely. I think everyone does, and they may be more prevalent in some of those trade organizations. But on the all, I think most of our membership leans towards the blue side of the aisle.
I think I've had that observation, because places like Jefferson County, which still has a lot of people right. who are either current or retired members of organized labor. In 2016, they voted for Eric Greitens, who had said that he was for right to work, which is the term that proponents use to describe a policy that bars unions and employers from requiring dues as a condition right. of employment. I think it asked you back then, like, how could union members vote for someone like Greitens when he's taking a position that is so so against their interests, right. basically. And a lot of it could have come down to his views on abortion and guns. Is that fair to say?
I would say that it probably fell down on the issue of guns more than abortion. But yeah, I think that's it for some of those far right people. I mean, you've got some pretty rough and tumble folks out on the construction field, and you know, they like their guns, and you know, maybe they were fooled by the Eric Greitens firing a minigun at a lake, if you call that, very quickly they figured out when the first bill to roll through the legislature, one of the first bills to roll through the legislature was right to work. I think there was some eye-opening awareness.
In the U.S. Senate race, GOP Senator Josh Hawley is trying to make his appeal to organized labor in what I would classify as more than just a superficial way. He's not only received some praise from Teamsters President Sean O'Brien at the Republican National Convention, but he's now disavowed right to work, which I described earlier. And he's also like championing a lot of other pro-union type things. Mm-hmm. What do you make of Hawley's transformation on labor issues, given that this was not how he entered the political scene sure. in 2016?
I think that, I think he's no fool. I think that, he's been elected to the United States Senate. You don't do that by easy pathway. And I think he's seen the polling that we have and certainly what happened in 2018, where Missourians soundly, and I mean soundly, defeated right to work by a huge margin. I'll be honest with you, that hasn't happened in other states. That happened here in Missouri, and I don't know another state that has repealed it through the voter process. Michigan repealed it recently through their legislative process, but Missouri has beat it twice, one in 1978 and once in 2018, and the margins got even larger in 2018. So I think he's sitting back and looking at what's the popular message right now, and certainly worker power, I think, is on the rise, and he probably wants to capitalize on that. But, you know, actions speak louder than words. That's not something he'll be able to vote on.
The Missouri AFL-CIO ended up endorsing Democrat Lucas Kuntz fairly early in the primary cycle, and when Hawley and Kuntz met earlier this month at the Missouri State Fair, I asked Hawley to elaborate on his newfound opposition to right to work, which prompted a response from Kuntz, who was standing right next to him. Here is that audio.
Because I think for Missouri, number one, we voted not to be a right to work state. Number two, I don't think it's fair to ask union organizers to have to organize for people who are not paying union dues. When you get a union contract, it's for all the workers in the shop, in the organization. But if a bunch of those people don't pay dues, but yet they get the benefit of the contract, I just think that's not fair. This is why I'm proud to be supported by the National Teamsters. I'm proud to be the most pro-labor Republican in the United States Senate, and we'll continue to fight for labor. I tell you what I won't do is take away the gas and diesel that our workers rely on, that Kuntz here wants to take away from them, and I will not give amnesty to 15 million illegals to take their jobs, which is what Kuntz wants.
Josh,
this would be so much easier if we just did this on the debate stage.
It would be, which is why I don't understand why you won't show up.
Dude, we're here.
When Roy Blunt voted for prevailing wage in the CHIPS Act just a couple years ago, Josh voted against it. He was a right to work candidate. He doesn't believe in labor. In fact, he's called half of labor hostage takers.
That's U.S. Senate candidates Josh Hawley and Lucas Kuntz at the Missouri State Fair earlier this month. So I understand what Kuntz is saying there. He's basically calling Hawley a fraud on this issue. But is it really a bad thing from your group's perspective for Hawley to shift his views on labor issues if it means he'll vote in a way that helps your membership if he wins re-election?
No, I'm happy that his politics have evolved on that. I look forward to his record changing from the 0% lifetime rating the AFL-CIO has given him to something else. So we'll see how that actually changes. Actions speak louder than words. And so, you know, if he is successful, I look forward to that 0% rating changing sometime.
Why did Missouri AFL-CIO endorse Kuntz so early on in the primary contest? I think that was notable, but I think it was also very helpful to him in the primary. So I'm interested in what went down there.
Well, you know, our state board got together and decided to do an early endorsement. And as I just said, Josh Hawley has a 0% rating from the AFL. And so we are looking for someone that has the best chance at beating him. And we soundly thought that that was going to be Lucas Kuntz. And so they wanted to jump out ahead. He had already had a significant fundraising advantage compared to everyone else. And we wanted to make sure that we were have a longer time period to try to help work that message.
Do you foresee both unions in Missouri and national unions getting involved in this contest from a financial standpoint? Or is it going to depend on polling? If Hawley is ahead by 20 points by September, October, I'm not sure if labor unions are going to want to expend a lot of money there. But if it's close, I could see them getting more involved. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. I'm certainly that we are going to include the race in all of our political programs, all of our member-to-member communication engagement. And so we're going to try, even if the money doesn't follow. But we'll just have to see.
We need to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Missouri AFL-CIO President Jay Kummel. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome back. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Now back to our Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air conversation with Jay Kummel, the president of the Missouri AFL-CIO. So can you talk about how Missouri AFL-CIO approached the primaries to the gubernatorial race? Because I think that you were involved with both the Republican and Democratic one.
That's correct. And you know, we went ahead and endorsed in both, something that we don't normally do. We endorsed both Crystal Quaid in the primary, Democratic primary, and we endorsed Mike Kehoe in the Republican primary. Crystal has been there for us every step of the way. Anything that we've ever needed, she's always been there for us. I have a good relationship with Mike Kehoe, and where we don't agree on everything, I think that Governor Kehoe is a smart enough man to know which way the Missouri voters are. And he's, as you know, he has recently made some statements on right to work, which is the number one issue for our unions, that he suggests that Missouri has spoken on that issue. And so that means a lot to us.
Well, let's actually hear from Lieutenant Governor Kehoe on the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air from, I think, July, where he talked about right to work.
Listen, when I was the majority leader in the Senate, I supported right to work. We had it passed. It was signed by the governor. And then 67.5% of Missourians decided it wasn't the right way to go. I have tried to maintain a good relationship with organized labor because there's some issues we're not going to agree on. But at the end of the day, they represent a well-trained workforce that can get things done on time and under budget. And we talk about workforce development in this state all the time. Every state talks about workforce development. And the trades really have an incredibly well-trained workforce, whether it's 562 pipe fitters in their new training center, carpenters, sheet metal workers. I've been in most of those training centers. I really appreciate what the trades men and women do and the quality of job that they can bring to that. So there's spots we're going to disagree on things, but for the most part, keeping men and women to work and improving the state's economy is something that's very important to me.
So based off that answer, you'd veto it? You'd veto right to work?
Well, there's different versions of right to work going on around out there in the conversation. Some of them are county to county, opt-in and opt-out. So I would love to see the piece of legislation that you asked me whether I'll sign or veto before I just say a blanket word to that.
That was Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe, the GOP nominee for Missouri governor, on a recent edition of the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'll just ask, does that statement concern you at all, given that he didn't say he would veto right to work with a yes or no answer?
Of course, absolutely. I mean, and that's for that reason we've endorsed Crystal Quaid in the general election. We think that she's the best option going forward. She'll be with us on everything. She has made no bones about it that she would veto right to work. But, you know, in the primary, for some of our members, as you suggested, that lean towards the other side of the aisle, we wanted to help steer them into a direction with somebody that we could at least work with.
Are you expecting that individual labor unions will provide a more robust amount of money for Quaid than they did in the primary election? Because I looked at it, she didn't get as much as a typical Democratic candidate for governor usually gets.
Yeah. You know, I would have to ask those individually. I mean, the amount of money that I have in our PAC is very small as the umbrella organization, and our individual unions make up those decisions on how they spend their members' dollars. And I think they take a good look at how close the race is, you know, what the margin is, when they decide whether or not to invest. And I think a lot of people wanted to wait and see how the primaries played out. And as you know, I think that Democratic primary looked to be up in the air for a little while. And I think that maybe that's why some of them sat out, and we certainly did not. But
yeah, we will have to see where the money flows. So let's talk about perhaps a more controversial thing, and that's the Missouri 1st Congressional District race, where St. Louis County Prosecutor Wesley Bell defeated Congresswoman Cori Bush. Okay, there was some conjecture about how labor writ large worked to defeat Representative Bush, which is not true. There were a number of unions that supported Congresswoman Bush's reelection, but it appears a lot of trade unions in particular were still upset over her no vote on a 2021 infrastructure bill. Why do you think that tension remained going into this 2024 election?
Well, it wasn't just the trade unions, but it was, and if you want to expand on the trade unions, I think it was our machinists that, you know, we represent thousands and thousands of people that work at Boeing that build fighter aircraft, some of the best in the world. And those are jobs that pay on average $85,000 a year, one of the largest employers in the 1st Congressional District. And when you have somebody that will not help bring back the money to keep that fighter line open and all the jobs that provides, I think that's an issue for not just the infrastructure, but for some of our other organizations that represent those employees. And as you said, a lot of our, I can think of three or four that went out and knocked doors for the Congresswoman. And I applaud them for that. They decided that's what they wanted to do. We left it open. We left it open so that our individual unions could decide for themselves, because it was contentious. It was contentious across St. Louis. It was contentious certainly in our organizations. And we freed everyone up to go out and do what they thought was the best for them.
I think one of the things I've been a bit confused about is the unions who are upset over the infrastructure bill. That happened in 2021, but I don't recall a lot of unions being actively working to defeat Bush in 2022 when she was running against State Senator Steve Roberts. So why put so much emphasis on a vote that occurred 3 years ago instead of like what she did in 2023 or 2024?
Yeah, so when the infrastructure vote happened, I had talked to Congresswoman before the vote happened, and she had, me and several people were on the call. And she had suggested she wanted to really be a vote yes on both of them. And we had, and she kind of flip-flopped back around a little bit and said, well, you know, if I can't vote for one, I won't vote for other. And I said, let me just be very clear, Congressman, we expect a yes vote on both. Both of those bills, the Build Back Better and the infrastructure vote, were equally important to our membership. And there was no wiggle room on not voting for both of those things. The infrastructure bill was a $1 trillion, once-in-a-generation investment in this country. And when I drive down any street in St. Louis, the amount of potholes, the bridges that are in disrepair, the lead water lines that we have in almost every house going in South St. Louis, North St. Louis, Central Corridor, those are things that my members directly go to work for in those trades. And that was an unforgivable act for her to be one of six Democrats to turn their back on the president and turn their back on union tradespeople trying to revitalize and re-energize our infrastructure in this country. And they just were not going to forget that.
Even though it happened 3 years ago.
That's right. And I will tell you that last election before, when Senator Roberts was running against Congresswoman Bush, we chose to leave that open then as well because of that vote. We had a sit down with the heads of the building trades and ourselves with the congresswoman, and we said, you need to repair this relationship going forward. We are not going to change our mind and endorse you. We need you to sit down. We need you to come to the building trades and explain to them what happened or what you say happened, and make inroads so that we can move forward. And she refused to do that. And so there we are.
It does seem, though, that Bell, who will likely become the next congressperson, it has some bridge building to do, even within the entirety of organized labor. Do you think that he can do that?
Yeah, and let me be clear. Some of our unions that supported the congresswoman, they're not happy. Obviously, they as strongly as some of our trades groups felt about that vote, they felt just as strongly about the things that they support the congresswoman on. And so I don't want to leave that out. They're not happy about that. And
no,
so yes,
they're not.
He is going to have to go to them and make some inroads and hear their issues and their needs. But you know what? I think he's the person that will actually do that.
Jake Hummel is the president of the Missouri AFL-CIO. Jake, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
As we veer toward Missouri's general election cycle, I've noticed that there's a very, very popular way for campaigns to try and connect to voters: text messaging. On the day before Missouri's primary, I received a flood of text messages from candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, treasurer, secretary of state, and attorney general. Some of the texts were fairly general. Hey, vote for candidate A because candidate A is going to make Missouri amazing. Others sought to bring down their adversaries, with some gubernatorial candidates even sending links to nasty attack ads. In some respects, this strategy was effective at getting my attention, especially since our household got rid of cable a year ago and I don't watch much television. But the texting became so frequent near the end of the campaign that I seriously thought about throwing my phone in the river to pair to escape the deluge of rhetoric. I decided not to because, among other reasons, I wouldn't be able to make my new Instagram reels. And I don't want to deprive you, the awesome listener that you are, of videos that have featured me wearing a cowboy hat at the Missouri State Fair and teleporting from place to place with my new clothing steamer that my mother-in-law purchased for me for my 40th birthday. But I digress. It appears I wasn't alone in my frustration. I put out a post on X earlier this month asking our listeners if they've received a lot of political text messages. And the response was frankly overwhelmingly negative. Amy wrote, "Yes, I'm a longtime Democratic voter who has been getting Republican texts for gubernatorial, AG, and Secretary of State races. Why waste their money on me?" Former State Representative Sarah Walsh wrote, "I keep texting stop, but many of them don't stop. The same message frequently just comes from a different number. As a former candidate, I understand the need to get one's message out, but this election, it has been out of control, especially the negative ads." Some elected officials say that texting is a more cost-effective version of campaign mailers, since the major financial outlay here is obtaining a list of phone numbers. State Senator Travis Fitzwater of Callaway County wrote, "I'm an aggressive stop replier to these. It's why I only get a few here and there anymore, but we did use it on our campaign 2 years ago with decent returns, but we use them with engaging content, not just text. So I get why they're used." James Harris is a Republican political consultant. Many of his candidates in this year's primary cycle used text messaging. Some texts contained full advertisements, while others may have included messaging that appeared on mailers. Harris says candidates use text messages for a simple reason: they get people's attention.
we're almost like Pavlov's dog now. If the phone vibrates, we check it, right? Most people have their phone either in their pocket, within arm's reach, in a bag, you know, a purse, etc. And many people can sleep with their phones nearby as they continue maybe to cut the cords from traditional land-based phones. And so we know from a political perspective, voters have those phones in close proximity to them. So it makes it a great avenue to communicate with them.
But Harris also acknowledges texting can turn voters off, especially if they're too frequent or they're too negative. And he also conceded that texting may not always reach people that campaigns need to turn out in elections.
You know, one of the challenges with texting is, depending on the voter file and the data you're getting, you know, potentially a third to 35% of the cell numbers are not accurate, so it's not a complete match. So there are some, you know, downsides.
One other downside, Harris points out that Android phones filter certain text messages as spam. That feature isn't available for the iPhone yet, but given how Apple seems to copy a lot of Android features, a filter is probably just around the corner. And there are also rules from the Federal Communication Commission in place that could give campaigns pause before engaging in rampant texting. But for now, political text messaging is here to stay, and it may come back with a vengeance as November 5th creeps closer.
Today's episode was produced by Jason Rosenbaum.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.